Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. John White. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at WebMD. Are you happy? Do you want to be happier? Can science help you on the path to happiness? My guest today says it can. He's co-authored a book with no other than Oprah Winfrey that's entitled Build the Life You Want, The Art and Science of Getting Happier. Dr. Brooks, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to be with you.
I have to say, I really enjoyed your book. What I was fascinated by up front, you say, people say to you, you must naturally be very happy, given your disposition, even how we were talking beforehand. But you say, that's hardly the fact. What's going on here?
There is a small handful of social scientists and neuroscientists in the United States who study happiness. I think I know them all. And I think it's fair to say that they're not an above average happiness group. And that might sound strange to begin with, but it really shouldn't surprise anybody. We study happiness for a reason. You know, we want it. Everybody wants it. And if you have the toolkit to find more of it, you're going to dedicate yourself to the discovery of that. Kind of a struggle, or if it at least doesn't come naturally to you. And the good news is that you're not going to find happiness per se, because happiness is not a destination, it's a direction. But you can get a lot happier. And I'm living proof that that's the case. Since I've dedicated myself to the science of happiness, my happiness has risen every year. And I'm looking forward to it rising for the rest of my life, as long as I stay on the path.
You say the science of happiness. How do we study happiness? How is there a randomized clinical trial? Where's the placebo? You have in your book, some people kind of say, is the science of happiness like astronomy? But others might say that it's like astrology. Help us understand, how are you creating a science? Because that's what the book is about, using neuroscience to give us tips and tools to make us happier.
Well, there's two ways that science really helps us to understand happiness. One is psychology and the other is biology. On the psychological side, that's social science. That's how I'm trained. I'm trained as a behavioral economist. And what we're trained to do is to look at large data sets and then use statistical techniques to simulate these drug experimental conditions. In other words, we can net out the things that are probably not causal in helping us to understand a phenomenon under consideration. If you find a group of people and some of them are happier than others, you want to look at all the things in their background, all the things that they're doing, and then you want to see statistically how each one of those things individually affects or is associated with their happiness. If you want to get even better at it, you do experiments. And that's what the field is really doing in social psychology, where we simulate real life in experiments where half of the people are exposed to a certain condition and randomly another half are not exposed to it. So it really does look like a drug treatment and control experiment. And that's where we're finding our most cutting edge data. You can take two groups of students and half of them just go about their lives randomly selected. And the other half have to write a gratitude list, the top five things for which they're grateful, and then study the list every night and then update their list on Sunday. By the end of 10 weeks, they'll be on average 12% happier. And boy, oh boy, if I had a drug test that had a 12% effect, I would be a billionaire.
How do we do that? Do we do that by a survey? Or you talk in your book about neuroimaging.
Well, this is where the biology comes in. This is where neuroscience starts to play a very exciting role. So some of the times you just ask people about the differences in their life, and that's how you figure out whether or not something is having an impact. But sometimes you want a little bit more biological verification of what's going on. And we're getting better and better at understanding how the brain is processing different kinds of cognitions, different sorts of mental states. We understand more and more about the so-called limbic system. That's a console of tissue that was evolved over a 40 million year period. It has one job, which is to translate the outside world stimuli, the things that you see and smell and hear and touch, and turn those things into information so that you know how to react. That information is another word. It's called emotions. Your limbic system creates emotions, nothing more positive and negative, to give you information about whether something is something you should avoid or something you should approach. And all those emotions, all those feelings are created in different parts of the brain. And we can actually see how the brain is processing those different emotions with brain imaging. We can see, for example, the amygdala, how it's active when people feel fear or they feel anger, how the insular cortex, when people are feeling disgust, either at a substance or at another person. And then we see how those create emotions that we actually will react to that make us happier or unhappier.
What's the role of genetics?
Well, the role of genetics, let's just say it's a depressing role, John. It's not something that I like particularly, but it's very important for us to understand. Now, this is another one of these scientific type experiments. There's a database of identical twins. These identical twins were born over about a 30-year period, and they were adopted into separate families. So what does this do? It gives us a natural kind of experimental set of conditions where you have these two twins who are carbon copies genetically, but they have different upbringings. And we can use statistical techniques to see what part of their personalities and their attitude toward life, including their general mood balance, their positive and negative moods, are genetic and which parts are circumstantial. And you find based on that, that not your happiness, but really how you feel from day to day, how much positive emotion versus how much negative emotion you feel, that's about 50% genetic. And that's important because it turns out that if you know that, for example, if you know that you have kind of a gloomy tendency based on your parents, you'll be a lot more careful with your habits. Same thing is true, John, for anything else. If you went to your doctor and you said, you know, both my parents drink too much and all four of my grandparents, I have a genetic tendency to drink too much. Your doctor would say, behavior, 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 don't drink. Same thing with happiness.
But there's not a gene as there is for some other conditions where we can test for genetic predisposition, correct?
That's correct. We don't have that kind of specificity. We can't get that granular with what we're doing. And that's too bad. I wish we did, but we'll do the best we can nonetheless and get things that are directionally right so that we can give people good advice.
What about one's environment? Is that the bigger play? You kind of said 50%. That's kind of right in the middle, Arthur. Which is more? Is it genetics? Is it environment? I'm going to come to a couple different things.
Well, it's sort of 50-50, but environment is split into two baskets itself. So the environment has two parts to it, circumstances and habits. So that matters an awful lot. Now, your circumstances, you don't control them very much. You can give yourself better luck through your habits, but generally speaking, you know, bad things are going to happen to you or negative things are going to happen to you, even in the best of lives, and positive things are going to happen in the worst of lives. You find that at any given moment, about somewhere between 10 and 40% of your happiness, let's just say 25% to make it, you know, roughly something we can manage, about a quarter of your happiness, and it comes from what's going on. If good things are happening, it pushes your happiness up by a quarter. If bad things are happening, it pushes your happiness down by a quarter. But here's the thing. It doesn't last. Your circumstances never affect your mood for very long because your mood has to be transient. Because remember, emotions are information about the outside world and you need to be ready for the next set of circumstances. So people think, boy, if my girlfriend breaks up with me, I'm going to be sad forever. No, you're not. You're going to be really sad for a couple of weeks and listening to sad songs. You're going to be kind of sensitive about it for about 6 months. But if you, you know, behave yourself and pay attention and get some good advice, by a year from now, you're going to be dating somebody else and you'll be pretty good because you can't be controlled by your positive and negative circumstances.
What about folks that say, Arthur, you can just wish yourself to be happy. You can make yourself happy. Is that true?
Well, you can and you can't. The truth is that if you're managed by your emotions, you're going to be a lot worse off. But there are lots of things that we can do. That's not wishing. It's actually working. There's no wishing. It's always working. It's the same thing with your physical health. You can say, I wish my blood pressure were lower. Well, I got a better idea. Start eating right and get into the gym. And then the working will actually do what your wishing did much more effectively than it would have otherwise. That's important. It's the same thing with happiness. You're not going to wish yourself happier, but you can work yourself to greater happiness by managing your emotions so that they don't manage you. And that means being conscious of what your emotions are and then using a set of techniques that we talk about, that Oprah Winfrey and I talk about in this book, about actually how to do that.
So Arthur, let me ask you the question that everyone has on their mind. How did Oprah get your phone number?
I often ask myself that, but when Oprah Winfrey calls and says it's Oprah Winfrey, of course, you don't quite believe it. You know, yeah, and I'm Batman. The reason that we got connected is because she's a reader of my regular column in The Atlantic, which she was reading over the coronavirus epidemic when she was locked down at her house, just like everybody was locked down in their houses. She's an omnivorous reader of information, is very interested in the science of happiness, got interested in my column. And when my last book came out, before the book that I wrote with her came out, she read it on the first day and called me up and said, what do you say we do some stuff together? And I said, let me think. Yes.
I was going to ask you, you say one way to be happy is to teach happy. But we know as scientists, if we're saying this as scientists, you don't test on yourself, that we have inherent biases. So is that a good idea?
No, that's right. No, so but the whole point is that when you're getting the knowledge to other people, you start thinking about it more systematically in your own case, and you remember the hygiene is what it comes down to. And so that's one of the things that I found that people who, you know, I have many, many friends who are physicians, and they'll say the same thing. It's like when they're spending all day long saying, you know, cut down on your trans fats and get into the gym, they're like, yeah, I should cut down on my trans fats and get into the gym.
Well, when people say it's your attitude, what do you say to folks that use that term? You got a bad attitude. Arthur, if you didn't have a bad attitude, you'd be happier. You've used emotions and some other terms, but let's be honest, that's what people are thinking. It's attitude, is it?
It's true, but it's also not true. You can't just say, okay, I have a good attitude now. You have to do the work to have a better attitude. And that means you need to understand what a better attitude is. So for example, you can substitute one emotion for the other, but you have to be very aware of your own emotions. I recommend that you meditate on your own emotions, or that you journal your emotions, or that you pray about your emotions, or you get therapy or whatever you need to do. But the more you're conscious of your emotions, then you can substitute one emotion for the other. But when you're not conscious of them, you'll be managed by them. And to say, have a better attitude, is like basically saying, just lower your blood pressure. It's not helpful until you have a technique for doing so. If somebody says, lower your blood pressure by not eating so many trans fats and working out for 30 minutes a day, now you got something you can hang your hat on.
Can't be at WebMD and not ask you about the role of health and happiness. What is that connection? Because many people that have chronic disease, that are suffering in pain, who don't have good health, aren't happy. So what's that connection between health and happiness?
Yeah, this is one that I've studied a lot because I'm kind of interested in nutrition and I'm an inveterate exerciser. And for the longest time, I thought, well, you know, it really improves my happiness a lot. Turns out it doesn't, but it does improve my well-being. And I'm not splitting hairs here. It's important for us to understand that happiness and unhappiness are separate. Happiness and unhappiness are largely processed in different hemispheres of the brain, as a matter of fact. And we know this by looking at how people react in different parts of your, you know, how your brain reacts. You find that the right half of the brain controls the left half of your face, for example. And people, when they're feeling unhappy, the left half of their face starts to twitch a little bit.
That's that corpus callosum. We don't want to give a biology. Yes.
Yeah, I understand. Well, the corpus callosum, of course, is where you communicate from one hemisphere to the other. It's right down the middle of your brain. But the whole point is that happiness and unhappiness are separate, and you need to manage happiness to be higher, and you need to manage your unhappiness to be lower. Now, people who have naturally high levels of negative emotion, and negative emotion is the same for everybody, is fear and anger and disgust and sadness. Those are the four negative emotions. We all have them. They're all important. There's nothing wrong with those emotions. They're not broken because you have them. But if you have very high or intense negative emotions, you need to learn how to manage them, not to get rid of them, not to numb them with drugs and alcohol, but to manage them. One of the ways to manage negative emotions is exercise, health. That's what you find, is that when people have really bad health, either because of their bad habits or for no fault of their own, it tends to raise their negative affect levels. And that means you need to manage your negative affect levels by taking those things on directly. You are made as a human being to have a full range of emotions. John, if I offered you the deal, hey, John, I got a deal for you. I'm going to get rid of your sadness forever. You should not take the deal. Because if you did, you'd lose your marriage, you'd lose your friends, and you'd lose your job. And the reason is because you no longer care about losing connection with other people. That's what sadness is all about. It makes you averse to losing something you really care about, usually a relationship with somebody that you love. That's the quintessential kind of sadness. The same thing is true with fear. If I got rid of your fear, you'd be dead in a week because you wouldn't actually be averse to threats. If I said, I'm going to get rid of your disgust, you'd get poisoned.
It's a strong word, disgust. I like how you use that.
Yeah. And there's a certain part of the brain dedicated to disgust because you need it to keep you safe and alive and healthy. And that means that negative emotions are a very important part of a full life. Furthermore, negative experiences are the way that you learn and you find meaning in your life. The important thing for us to understand is that a full life, full of well-being, has the full range of emotions and experiences. One of the biggest ways that we poorly serve young people today, you know, is that we say it's kind of the opposite of what the hippies used to say. They used to say, if it feels good, do it, which is a great way to ruin your life, by the way. But an even better way to ruin your life is to say, if it feels bad, make it stop. No. You need suffering in your life. You need pain in your life. You need fear in your life. You need these things so that you can learn and grow. They could be maladapted. They can be too strong. They can become a medical problem, to be sure. But the idea of thinking there's something wrong with me because I'm sad. No, because you're alive is why you're sad. And you need to learn about managing it and learning from it and growing from it. Unhappiness is literally part of happiness.
Well, I think this helps me understand something you said in the book that I wasn't so sure of that I wanted to ask you, where you say for kids, I'm paraphrasing, maybe trophies aren't so good. So I'm thinking, should I remove the trophy shelves in my kids' room? But I think I know what you're getting at. So when it comes to kids and happiness, how do we help them maximize their happiness? And what's this role of trophies?
Well, trophies are a funny business, and I've written about that quite a bit. The problem with them, and many are really good and healthy. I mean, the whole idea of something nice happened to you and you remind yourself of a lovely day. But the problem is when you consider that getting to the end of something is the be-all and end-all, you tend to have a life full of disappointments. It's a funny thing. I've studied Olympic athletes and found that they tend to be depressed in the month after they win their gold medal. Why is that? And the reason is because they tended to think that if they won, that they would be permanently happier than they were. And it's not true. When we set kids up to think that if you get the job, if you get the diploma, if you get the grade, if you get this, then you'll be happy, we're setting them up to be frustrated and disappointed with their lives. On the contrary, if we help them understand that having good relationships, that having a lot of love, that having healthy friendships, that making progress toward their goals, not hitting the goals per se, that these are the essence of a happy life, then the trophies don't mean as much. But if we're a trophy-based existence, especially for kids, if you get that A, if you get into Harvard, then you'll finally be happy. Sorry, it's a lie, and it sets people up to not live their best lives.
But you're at Harvard.
It turns out it's not the source of my happiness. It's a nice opportunity, I have to say. But if I had been living my entire adult life saying that if I can ever get a professorship at Harvard University, then everything is going to be happy. When I got here, it would be one of the bitterest disappointments I ever recognized. When I came here, I was a professor studying the basic biology and psychology of happiness. And I knew full well that it was going to be like any other job. Nice in many ways and a lot of pressure in others, but certainly not the source of my happiness.
Arthur, what's the role of faith? I was struck by when I was reading up on you that you go to church, you go to Mass most days of the week. And traditionally, the church, faith, hasn't always been about happiness in this world. So what is that role of faith? And how does that play into our happiness?
Faith is a class of experiences that we call the transcendent. The transcendent might be about heaven, but it might just be about things that are bigger than us. I do practice my faith. I pray every day. I go to Mass almost every day, and it is a great source of solace and happiness for me, but it's not the only path. What people need is something that transcends their daily psychodrama. If we're left to our devices, we're the star of the most boring television show on planet Earth, and yet we're fascinated, we're obsessed with this television show, and it drives us crazy. It drives us mad. We need relief. And the only way we can get relief is through peace and perspective. And that only comes from getting smaller, not getting bigger, by zooming out, not zooming in. And transcendent experiences bring that. Maybe that's a meditation practice. Maybe that's walking in nature without devices. Maybe that's studying the fugues of Johann Sebastian Bach. Maybe that's understanding the Stoic philosophers, or maybe that's the faith of your youth, like me. But everybody needs something transcendent that in the vernacular, we could just call it faith, but it might be religious, but it might not be.
How do we manage social media? So many of us are aware of the data that suggests, constantly scrolling through various social media sites can make people more depressed. But realistically, people aren't going to give them up. So how do you manage that in a setting of trying to be happier?
Yeah, let's first understand what social media does to happiness. It has kind of three effects on happiness. Number one, it sets us up for social comparison. And social comparison is horrible for your happiness because you'll always find somebody who is better than you, more beautiful than you, or richer than you, and you will feel lower than you were before. That's number one. Number two, it tends to make you feel lonely. And one of the reasons it makes you feel lonely is a very simple physiological process called the pathways of oxytocin. Oxytocin is a neuropeptide, as you know full well, and many of your listeners do as well. It actually functions as a hormone in the brain that's the hormone of human bonding. It really only comes from eye contact and touch. When you're feeling lonely, that feeling of loneliness really is a deficit of oxytocin in your brain and is intensely uncomfortable. And so you look for ways to satisfy your need for oxytocin. One of the things that people often do is they go to social media, but that's like getting all your calories from fast food. It'll give you tons of calories, but not enough nutrients, and which is one of the reasons that people will scroll social media or spend a lot of time on social media, and each increasing hour leads you to more loneliness, not less. So loneliness is number two. And the third is hatred, especially on a platform like Twitter, or I guess it's X now. You find that it's the algorithms are set up so that you will find your political enemies and feel contempt for them. It'll set you up to feel oppositional to other people. Now, you can curate it in such a way that it doesn't have to do that, but you find that the more time people are politically engaged on social media, the more hateful and contemptuous they become, which is horrible for their happiness. The bottom line is less social media is better for your happiness. And if you're going to use it, you have to use it responsibly in much the same way that you would if you use any form of alcohol. You should moderate it. You should use it responsibly. You should not try to make it a solo endeavor. So you should connect yourself to friends as much as possible. And I recommend, to be very specific about it, that you limit all of your social media use across all platforms to 30 minutes a day or less, and do it in all one time period that's scheduled. I also recommend that you not use your phone. I recommend you use the computer to do it because it's less addictive when you do it that way.
Give us one or two other tips from your book. I want people to get your book, so we don't want to give away too much. We've already told folks a lot. But if there was one or two things that people could start doing today that would impact their happiness, what would it be? So for example, people often say to me, you know, what could I start doing today that could, you know, reduce my risk of disease? I actually tell them they could focus on quality sleep. That over time is going to have tremendous health benefit. Maybe not, you know, the next week, but over time. So what's something that they could start doing today that is overall going to make their lives happier?
The number one input into happiness is simple. It's love, but it's so complex. Love really has four dimensions to it. There's love of the transcendent or the divine. There's love of family, which are mystical relationships that we didn't choose, and God knows we wouldn't have in so many cases. There's friendships, which are important that they be real friends and not deal friends. And there's love that we express toward everybody in the way that we do our work, if we're doing our work well. But the bottom line is that every single person listening to us can be better across one or more of those dimensions. The first thing to do today is to write down four words: faith, family, friends, and work. And then take an inventory, give yourself a grade on each one. How much love am I getting and giving in each one of those dimensions of my life? And if you're not getting a good enough grade, you need to be spending more time on that dimension. And ideally, you should be spending at least a few minutes every single day on each one of those dimensions.
All right. I had some work to do.
We all do. That's the good news. I mean, it's like, you know, you as a physician, I mean, there's nobody who's completely on point. People think it's so terrible. Oh, everybody has to do work to get healthier. No, that's great news. All of us have things that we can do to feel better and to enjoy better health and to have better health span. And the same thing is true for our happiness. We all have things that we can do, and we all can get happier.
Dr. Arthur Brooks, I have thoroughly enjoyed our discussion. I have thoroughly enjoyed your book, and I highly recommend it to you, our listeners. Arthur, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much. And thanks to all our listeners for taking care of their health and looking out for others as well.
And thank you for listening. Please take a moment to follow, rate, and review this podcast on your favorite listening platform. This is Dr. John White for the WebMD Health Discovered podcast.